From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar, and this week we speak with Eric Dreitzer, political commentator and host of the website StopImperialism.org. Well, Eric, quite an interesting pair of weeks, the last two. The RNC in Cleveland, the DNC in Philly. Interesting articles that you've put out, one about the vote being hacked, perhaps, by Russians, and perhaps a myriad of others. And just the whole game that's being played out in this election. For me, what is really striking is the assumption of the role, basically, of Joe McCarthy by the Clinton campaign.
Yeah, really.
And looking at Trump as like the Siberian candidate.
Yeah, I mean, it's really coming down to that. And isn't it interesting that that the Russians have become this, like, you know, this sinister force? You know what I mean? They're in control of the ring or something, you know, in Sauron's castle, you know, and that they're secretly manipulating all of these things that are happening. And not only are the Russians responsible for the leaked emails that were into the hands of WikiLeaks, but Russia's responsible for seemingly everything, including the creation of Trump, you know. And it's quite interesting because in many ways what we've been saying for so long has really been proven true, namely that anytime anything goes wrong, blame Russia is really the default position for the Democrats and for the Democratic Party. And it's quite interesting because if you just look just with the emails, for example, look, the reality is that we don't know whether or not it was Russians or somebody connected to Russians or somebody else entirely who exactly hacked the DNC's emails. But what we can say for certain is that a lot of very good, very important information and intelligence came out of those emails that proved beyond a shadow of a doubt what we all knew was going on, namely that there was a DNC-sponsored conspiracy against Bernie Sanders to basically torpedo his campaign and to prop up Hillary Clinton's campaign. Now, it's funny because just a few months ago, there were literally dozens of stories in corporate media about how the Bernie Sanders people with just conspiracy theorists, you know, and this is so stupid. Why do you say this is all a conspiracy? Clearly Hillary won fair and square, blah, 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 blah. And here we are in late July. We have now the emails proving, I mean, emails not from, you know, some mid-level DNC apparatchiks. These are top-level DNC officials up to and including their communications director Luis Miranda and Debbie Wasserman Schultz herself. So we're talking the topmost echelon of DNC leadership openly conspiring, well, I guess not openly, but conspiring by email to suppress the Bernie movement in various ways. And look, I'm pretty open in that I wasn't a big Bernie supporter in the first place. I'm simply not, you know, but I know a conspiracy when I see one, and clearly they were conspiring to basically keep the wraps on the Bernie campaign as much as possible. And so we come back to this point that just a few months later, the corporate media has been proven to be once again complete and utter BS, that they have shown once again that they run interference for the establishment. And so I think that that's really important. And I'll say this, I'll go further than anybody will on corporate media. I'll say this, if the Russians did, in fact, hack the DNC and they were behind the email dump to WikiLeaks, then I'll say, thank you, Russia.
Yeah,
thank
an you active for whistleblowing.
For right. providing us with the evidence of what we all knew was happening. The evidence is critical, and wherever it came from, I'm very happy it's out there.
Somebody very sophisticated is involved in the dissemination as well, and that could well be Julian Assange. He's no dope. Because what happened before the second trove, which was released last weekend, immediately before it, on Friday, a week ago yesterday, or rather a week ago the day before yesterday, we're recording on Sunday, the 31st of July, the reply papers from the attorneys for Wasserman Schultz and the DNC and the other co-defendants in this lawsuit for up to $3 billion in Florida federal court that claims essentially fraud in the inducement of the campaign contributions to Bernie's campaign. Essentially, you said you were going to conduct a fair process. We made donations, assuming it was a fair process, based on, you know, in reliance upon what you said. Turns out you were lying. That lie was a fraud which induced our campaign donations. Certify us that donated to Bernie's campaign as a class, and give us back our money, plus treble damages, plus special punitive damages. $3 billion is the stated amount. And not that lawsuit, right? Yeah. So that the reply papers from Wasserman Schultz and DNC's lawyers at all were filed on Friday. And part of the defense, at first they said the service was bad, but they also said that the emails that you submitted as evidence are insufficient to state a case and consequently made a motion for summary judgment against the plaintiffs. So suddenly, like the next day, more emails come in that make it clear that the case can be stated, and you can bet they're going to be introduced into evidence in the next few days.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, this is far from over, I think. Now, it may be much too late to have an impact on this election. I don't know whether that's going to happen or not.
No, this won't have an impact. Right. It may in that some of the money that would have gone from Sanders' campaign to Clinton's campaign would be either tied up or removed from the thing, but they got plenty of money. Yeah. They got plenty of money.
They got plenty to replace it, so that's not really a concern. But I think it does. I think it does demonstrate just the degree to which the DNC really did work against the Bernie campaign. And I think that this is really important because, you know, we have a lot of information floating around right now. I guess some of it in the form of rumors, some of it confirmed, about various ways in which the Bernie campaign was more or less either suppressed by the DNC or potentially also working with the DNC. And one thing that I wanted to bring up, and we were talking about it before we started recording here, is some of the eyewitness accounts from the protests outside of the DNC. And I'm still kind of in the process of investigating it a little bit further, but I will just relay some of the eyewitness accounts that have been conveyed to me. One thing that was noticed about the protests was that there seemed to be some level of, I guess for lack of a better word, you could call it crowd control, but not crowd control in the sense of keeping them all in one place, quite the opposite. Crowd control in the sense of taking sections of the protesters, taking those sections and peeling them off, sending them to other parts of town, basically preventing the protests from congealing into one mass demonstration that might actually, let's say, get the attention of the corporate media and perhaps give a black eye in terms of public relations to the DNC. Right. So I have multiple eyewitnesses telling me about so-called de-escalation teams. These would be individuals with earpieces roaming through the crowd who, whenever the situation would get tense, would be involved in herding members of the protests to other parts of the city. And one of the examples that was given was the rumor that was spread around in the crowd about Bernie delegate coming out to speak and potentially also telling them about more actions that were going to be staged. This is in the hour or so after Hillary Clinton's acceptance speech. And supposedly this person comes out who's allegedly a Bernie delegate who promises that Jill Stein is going to be speaking in an hour or so at the boathouse, like a 15-minute walk away from where the demonstrations were happening. So a bunch of the crowd follows this person or follows whoever was leading over to where Jill Stein was supposed to speak. Jill Stein was not scheduled to speak there. She did not actually speak there, and nothing ever came of any event at the place that they said was happening. But it did have the effect of tamping down protests at precisely the moment that the DNC was wrapping up, the delegates were coming out of the building, and there was news cameras all over in that moment. And so I don't know what that sounds like to anybody who's listening, but that sounds to me like COINTELPRO tactics. Yep, that sounds to me like infiltration tactics. Now, the question that needs to be raised is, who was involved in doing that? What was the purpose of that? Why were they doing it? And at this point, I can't say, because I haven't given a fair shake to the people who I believe were involved in this, and I want to make sure that I get their take on it before I make any assertions. But just from the eyewitness accounts, it sounds to me a lot like some of the tactics that I saw at Occupy, some of the tactics that I saw at a number of other protests, including some of the Black Lives Matter protests. And this is one of the interesting things. What kind of infiltration did we have in the protests? Who was behind that and why? I'm going to be looking more into that. Hopefully I'll have something published in the next couple weeks.
You know, I witnessed you know, a few instances of this myself. I got to kind of set this up, because it was bizarre, the entire context, like the physical context there. In each case, in Cleveland and Philadelphia, they had the event, the convention, in the basketball arena for that city, in the Cleveland Cavaliers arena, which is the Quicken something or other in Cleveland.
Quicken Loans, yeah.
Yeah, Quicken Loans Center, whatever they call it. And then the Wells Fargo Center in Philadelphia. Each one of those is near the baseball stadium as well, and like they're across the parking lots. The RNC, they built a perimeter. In each case, the entire site, including the baseball and basketball arenas, were enclosed in fences with like four or five checkpoints to get in. You know, you had a giant fence that was probably 2 miles deep in Cleveland and probably 4 miles deep in Philadelphia. So once you went through a checkpoint, you had to walk like a mile in one case or 2 miles in another. So you were inside this security cup that was being maintained by the Secret Service, and they were visible. Those six guys over there are Secret Service, and those five guys, them too. Homeland Security, Philadelphia Police, and Pennsylvania State Police, and then myriad guys in black suits and stuff, and I don't know who the hell they were for. There were golf cart-sized tanks, that's all I could call them, that were all over the place. There were helicopters in Philadelphia overhead the entire time. And I'm talking overhead, not like, you know, up in the sky like we see them in Manhattan during a protest or something. This was like going on as soon as you walk outside to have a cigarette. That's the backdrop. So, you know, in terms of the need to disrupt protesters, every time there was a gathering of 100 or 50 or 200 Bernie delegates that would step outside of the basketball arena proper to the, you know, hallways outside, to the aisleways that, you know, where the vendors and all that are, which is where the media was set up in a lot of cases. Every time they came out there and started chanting, and we heard, hey, hey, DNC, we won't vote for Hillary, things like that, there was immediately like a perimeter set up around them of a mixture of all of these people. And they were like, if I'm sitting in my chair working, behind me is, you know, a phalanx of these guys. So there was no way anything was getting out of control at all. Mm-hmm. And yet they were disrupting. I mean, what you were describing essentially was COINTELPRO style disruption. That's the term that they used then too. Mm-hmm. So there's got to be another purpose behind it. It's not crowd control that they're exercising, and perhaps they were doing it five stages away from it being a threat. But it seemed more to me like visual messaging management and news gathering management. Now, just one more thing. There was this visual, for example, that I think conveys the whole view of the people that were managing this. When I first got there, the first day that I walked into, there was a mezzanine inside the arena overlooking everybody where the press was allowed to go on Tuesday. And so I went in and I'm leaning over the railing and taking it in visually, and it's, the place is packed, and there's a sea of blue signs that say Bernie on them. And I'm looking at this, and it kind of overwhelmed me. And then, you know, I realized, well, you know, they have about half the delegates. So, you know, the fact that there would be this whole wall of blue basically in there means, you know, like half the people have signs, and the Bernie people, almost everyone brought a sign. Okay, makes sense to me. It's going to make an interesting visual on TV when Clinton and everybody else speak. So then I start seeing people walk in carrying signs almost exactly that color, a slight shade off, but not something that broadcasts, and the same font style that said Stronger Together on it. And then when I saw it on TV, because where we were sitting, we had a big monitor we could watch, and if we wanted to listen to what was happening inside, I'd see shots framed with like maybe 8 people, 10 people. You'd see maybe 2, 3 Bernie signs and 1 or 2 Stronger Together signs. And it gave the impression, when they gave a wide shot of the arena, that those blue signs that you could see but not make out what they said were dispersed that way. That there was, you know, a very, almost as many people saying Stronger Together as there were Bernie signs. But that was far from the reality.
Yeah, and they also, I saw the media coverage attempting to hide the fact that once the Bernie delegates walked out of the convention, the place was damn near half empty. I mean,
they turned the lights off. When California walked out, when Leon Panetta was speaking, first, you know, they shut him down, or they tried to shut him down, first of all, saying no more war, no more war, and some other things. But the California delegation walked out, and they're huge. So there's a big gap because they sit together. And what happened? They turned the lights out over it. And then maybe 5 minutes later, the lights came back up, and the seats were filled, but not with the people that were in them before.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, we have a lot of information about these sort of tactics. And, you know, ultimately, I think the real question here is, what role has the DNC continued in playing? Because, you know, the leaked emails show that the DNC has been playing, you know, for Hillary the whole time. I don't think that this comes as a surprise to anybody. And similarly, the convention itself, you know, this had been planned for months, that the Bernie people were going to go to the convention and that they were going to make their voices heard and they were going to make their position known. And what you saw was that the DNC took it very seriously and planned for all of the disruptions and were able to minimize them in terms of the public relations of it. And well, quite frankly, I think one of the major mistakes, and this is just my opinion, one of the major mistakes by the Bernie people was to walk out of the arena. Yeah. I don't think that there was any reason to do that. I think that their impact was much greater inside, that they were able to actually, at the very least, change the conversation every time they made their voices heard. And I will tell you one other thing. Watching a Democratic convention, okay, the party that is allegedly the party of the left, right, the party that is allegedly the, you know, continues to be the party of protest and the party of young people and all of that, to see at a Democratic convention people chanting against war and then being drowned out by chants of USA, yeah. USA. You know, it struck me that all this talk about, you know, fascists of the Republican Party and fascists around Donald Trump and all of that, which is all very relevant and all very true and needs to be discussed, I think, openly. I got the distinct impression that the Democratic Party was becoming an increasingly fascist style party. I mean, to hear that at the DNC while they talk about unity, I mean, you know, unity and strength and all of this crap. Yeah, right. I mean, these are like standard fascist tropes. And in any event, the question that we were discussing here probably 3, 4, 5, 6 months ago that we've kind of had in the back of our minds the whole time has been answered. Namely, Does the Bernie campaign and their dissatisfaction with Hillary and the left in general and its dissatisfaction with Hillary, does that impact Hillary? Does that pull her to the left? Does that make her more progressive? The answer is clearly and resoundingly no. That in fact what we've seen is that over the course of the last couple of weeks, Hillary has moved further and further to the right, trying to play more to the neocons, parading around these insane generals on the stage talking about World War III. I mean, talking about war with Russia, talking about escalations all over the world. I mean, these people are strange-lovian, to say the least. And this is all happening under the so-called big tent of the Democratic Party. And so, again, I would pose the question to the Sanders people, do you still believe that you can impact the Democratic Party? Because you had a movement and a candidate that galvanized millions of people around this country and really legitimately pushed to possibly win the party's nomination. And not only did you not move the party to the left, it shifted further to the right, away from you, like a slap in the face. So ultimately, I think the bottom line here is the Democratic Party, not only can it not be reformed, it can't even be moved even slightly to the left. And so the answer for, I think, the Bernie people is a different political path, one that is outside of the Democratic Party. And again, I think the leaked emails once again demonstrate just how corrupt the DNC is. So hopefully the translation of all of this is the abandonment of the Democratic Party by millions of people en masse.
Now, to contrast, okay, you have the Bernie people that are there, and supposedly room is being made for them in the party. And Hillary Clinton even, you know, made those kinds of claims at the very end, after these people suffered every insult possible. For example, moving the Democratic Party to the left means that they had General Allen, Madeleine Albright, Michael Bloomberg prominently featured as speakers.
Mitt Romney,
okay. Now, and by the way, I'm waiting for the trove of emails because, you know, if they were doing this in the Democratic Party to Sanders, they were doing it in the Republican Party to Trump as well.
Oh, of course.
And so those emails, however, you know, there's also a lot of crosstalk emails between people from the RNC and people at the DNC because they're all lining up behind Clinton. And so those emails are the ones I want to see.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. Now, ultimately, we don't know who did the hacking, who got the emails. I'm sort of very wary of just going off of this assumption that the media has made that the Russians did it. Because, look, if anything, it's possible. Don't get me wrong.
Sure it is.
It's entirely possible. The Russians are, you know, some of the best in terms of international cyber hacking and things like that. You know, as what is it? Kaspersky Labs is considered the world's leader in, security and hacking, all that stuff. Yeah. Anyway, the point is the Russians very well could have done it, but there are plenty of other parties around the world who could have done that. And matter of fact, the information that has come out about, like, for instance, the way that Hillary treated her own email server, the way that the DNC has been using their own Gmail accounts and things like that. I mean, from my understanding of it, and I'm not a computer expert, but from people I've talked to who know a lot about it, it takes only the most minimal hacking skills to be able to get those emails.
Yeah, well, you know, not for nothing. I mean, among the potential suspect list, you don't only have Putin and Russian, secret services or whatever. I mean, you've got like a million or 10 million or 100 million around the world or more kids living in their parents' basement that sit there and do nothing but hack all over the world.
Yeah, exactly right. And you have there's limitless possibilities for who might have done it. But let's just assume for a second that the Russians did do that. What did they actually do? Did they manipulate vote counts? No. Did they buy off any particular candidates? No. did they do anything other than release to the public information that confirms what millions of us suspected? That's really all that happened. And so this whole media hoopla around it is really just deflection, right? That's ultimately right. what this is about. This right. is an attempt to deflect from the content of those emails, which demonstrate an anti-Bernie conspiracy. Right. And I mean, you know, there's so many people who shudder at the word conspiracy, but read the emails. Right. That is exactly the word. I mean, they were conspiring to keep down the Bernie movement in various ways, including direct collusion with corporate media. I mean, yeah. there are emails in there that show clearly that reporter from Politico had a deal with the Hillary camp to let them look over articles before they're published. Right. You had a reporter from the New York Times right. who had a similar deal, at the very least, to he was. Let's say, amenable to not discussing anything specific about the Joint Victory Fund. Well, the Joint Victory Fund is this very dubious fundraising mechanism or apparatus or whatever, you know, that is basically jointly controlled by the Hillary campaign and the DNC. In other words, it's right. the vehicle by which the DNC raised money for Hillary.
Right.
So the New York Times article was going to go into it in some detail, and the Hillary camp basically was able to get the article published with only minimal mention of the Joint Victory Fund. So Politico and the New York Times, we also, I mean, there's likely other emails in there haven't gone through.
They mentioned CNN and MSNBC as well, as if they were, like, you know, their press agents. And, yeah. you know, on that point, the most interesting thing to me, which I pointed out, I was sitting with Tony Montero, and I told him this. I said, you got to consider
something. You mean the current guest on Counterpunch Radio?
Yes, that's exactly right. Yes, yes. And my host in Philadelphia and my guest in Cleveland, we hung up. But I said, look, you got to consider something in terms of emails. There are certainly emails among the same people or the same institutions, corporations, certainly, around 1996 between people in the Clinton administration and executives at CNN and MSNBC and all these other places as they were crafting the Telecommunications Act, which enabled this construct that we have now to be used exactly in that way.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the Telecom Act of 96 is one of the most odious pieces of legislation that was passed under Clinton.
It
essentially created the media landscape we have now, or maybe a better way of saying that would be it created the corporate media monopolies that we have to deal with now, including, you know, lifting the restrictions on what can we say, you know, monopoly control over markets when it comes to media. Yeah. You know, there used to be laws that required some degree of diversity right. within the number of media outlets in a given city or in a given market. And that was thrown out the window by the Telecom Act. And that really created a situation where if you live in New York City or whatever, for example, you don't have any choice of who your cable company is going to be. Yeah. You have to buy if you're going to buy cable, you have to buy it from Time Warner, or you have to buy it from Cablevision or Optimum, or Comcast or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, that all of those, and there's much more. The rise of Clear Channel, yeah. which really creates the corporate landscape when it comes to radio that yep. we understand today.
That was the right wing radio boost. I mean, that's when that stuff really
exactly.
flashed. Yeah.
All of that is thanks to the Telecom Act of 96 and Bill Clinton. So, yes, you're absolutely right. But, you know, my point in bringing all of this up, my point in bringing up the Russian angle here is to say that is the currency that the DNC is going to try to play and use all the way to November, because now we have the media, you know, up in their sort of, you know, I don't know, their orgiastic self-congratulatory moods that they like to get in about, you know, the Russians are going to potentially hack the voting machines in November. wow, wait a second. Right. That is now really scary, right? Those big bad Russians are going to throw the election to their BFF, Donald Trump. At least that's what the media is saying. Right. But if you look at it a little more carefully, I think that that is not only false, but that is ridiculous when you consider the fact that even the most centrist and mainstream institutions that look at our electronic voting infrastructure in the U.S. have published reports saying not only is it unsafe, it is horribly outdated, completely open to all kinds of fraud from any direction, from almost any source, in almost any capacity, whether it's physically manipulating the voting machines, changing the cards and whatever, whether it's hacking into them through their wireless, their unsecured wireless signals, and a million other ways that the electronic voting infrastructure is easily manipulated. And then you look at the fact that all of the machines are basically the products of three or four companies, all of whom are connected to Wall Street, to finance capital, people like Warren Buffett, who owns the majority share of one of the major voting machine manufacturers. You look at the entire electronic voting machine system, and it is totally and completely open to manipulation, and it has nothing to do with the Russians. So now you look at the media going off on and on and on about the Russians hacking into these systems, and you ask yourself, are they setting up a scenario where any close election that Hillary loses is going to then be challenged in court because of potential hacking
by the Russians?
Well, that's what I'm getting at, because the narrative in the media is that Trump is backed by the Russians.
Yep.
So does that mean that let's say we have a scenario where Trump squeaks out victories in Michigan and in Ohio and in Pennsylvania and potentially Florida, and he carries that to an electoral victory? I don't think that's likely to happen, but let's assume that that did happen, because that is what Trump would need to win this election. Let's assume that happened and Trump barely wins. He wins with 275 electoral votes or something like that. You think for a second that the Democrats are not going to then claim that the Russians hacked these systems? Of course they will. Of course they will. And they'll be able to manufacture quote-unquote evidence to make it look like that happened, because anybody could hack these systems. So this is part of the point here, is that it's not just that the political apparatus of our elections is entirely corrupted. It's that the very infrastructure of our elections is totally corrupted and totally open to manipulation. And that is by design. Because we could think back to 2000. We could think back to 2004. And some of the electoral irregularities we saw in places like Ohio in 2004. Right. There's a reason why there needs to be, let's say, room for manipulation in these elections, because the establishment has to make sure that their person wins.
You know, on that point, I spoke a couple of weeks ago with Bob Fitrakis, and the audit system on a lot of these machines essentially consists of pushing a button and having it recalculate what it reported earlier. He calls it push and pray. And so there is no trail. There's no auditable trail. All it does, you ask the machine to audit itself, and it reports back the same findings. That's the infrastructure. So, looking at the accusation.
And I'm sorry, I just want to add, we also have documented evidence. And by the way, this is not me, just making this up. The Brennan Center at NYU, not exactly, a fringe organization, as mainstream as mainstream gets. And it's on the, Democratic Party's payroll, more or less.
Right.
The Brennan Center has reports showing how many of these states are running systems that are totally easily manipulated, and also the level of quote-unquote errors and mistakes that these machines make, what they call the flipped vote, where somebody puts in a vote for, say a Republican and it flips to a Democrat or vice versa, or you put in a vote for Jill Stein in the Green Party and it's somehow counted as a vote for Hillary. We've seen this over and over and over again. This is documented as well. Like I said, there are many methods by which these machines can throw the elections.
They even did it with punch cards. We had vote flipping for Pat Buchanan, for example, people that voted for Al Gore in Florida. In 2000.
Right, and then they said it was the hanging chads and all this other crap. But, I mean, the truth is that now, especially, I mean, 2000 was, I mean, that was 16 years ago. In that time, so many more counties and jurisdictions and electoral boards have become, you know, e-voting machines that we have to ask, the question, if the Brennan Center report says that a significant percentage of our voting machines are suspect, how can we trust any results that come out of any of them? And in an election that is going to be close, presumably, I don't personally think it'll be close, but many people do. In an election that's going to be close, where these states are up for grabs, how can anybody trust and validate the results of the elections?
You know,
I mean, it's incredible. It's crazy. And by the way, I was in Venezuela in December for the elections. You should see what their electoral system looks like. You should see the security measures on their voting machines. You got to go. You got to put your thumb into the thing to show your fingerprint. Fingerprint has to match with the name on your driver's license or your government ID. You have to present that information when you show up to do the vote. You go in, you register your vote, you drop in the piece of paper into a lock. I mean, the systems that they have in place there, which are 100% auditable and have a paper trail, because when you register your vote and you do your thumbprint, you register your vote, you get a paper printout. And that paper printout also has to be submitted. So when they audit the systems in Venezuela, they have to match the machine readout of the vote count with the paper receipts, and each one has to correspond directly. So there's really almost no way to manipulate the results of Venezuela's elections, because quite frankly, we saw that in December. The opposition won big time.
Right.
You know, if the government had the opportunity to rig elections, they certainly would have done it in December, and they lost major elections. So anyway, I bring that up only to point out that the U.S., that trumpets democracy and all this crap all over the world, has no such thing at home.
Yeah. I'm looking at the specter of the Democratic candidate running on a policy of getting tough with Russia abroad and
as completely insane as that, like is. That is,
and of Russian spies at home and collaborators. I mean, you know, they're treating Trump like he's literally the Siberian candidate, you know, a Russian version of the Manchurian candidate, that he's a puppet of Vladimir Putin somehow. Trump said at the convention in his acceptance speech, no more regime change. No more, you know, destroying countries. We don't need to go to war with Russia and China. That's what's out there coming from the Republican candidate. And let me tell you, being on the floor of the Republican convention when he was speaking, and I was back practically at the stage. So when I looked at the audience, I was actually looking at like maybe 75 to 90% of the audience, you know, within my view. And when he said those things, he got massive applause from the Republicans at that convention.
Well, you know, yes, but we have to also remember, number one, many of the neocons stayed away. So, you know, it was a Trump crowd. I'm not suggesting that there hasn't been a major change in the Republican Party. There obviously has been, certainly in terms of the mood of the Republican Party. But at the end of the day, the Trumpism or whatever, you know, the Trump movement within the Republican Party is not the entire party. And there is, and I've been saying this to a lot of people who talk about this issue, I think that you should be very cautious, because if Trump loses in a landslide loss to Hillary, you can bet your bottom dollar that the neocons are going to come resurgent in the Republican Party and try to take it right back and say, you see, this is what happens when you follow people like Trump, when you follow of these course. Kind of policies.
That's what's being done in the Democratic Party already. What they've
essentially, you know, they yeah, had, that's right. Essentially.
Bernie Sanders, I mean, you know, Tony Montero speaks of three movements, the movement represented by the vote behind Trump, the movement represented by the vote behind Sanders, and then the people in the streets, Black Lives Matter, and others that are in the streets right now. There's a lot of action in the streets, as you know. And yeah, so you've got these three masses that all pretty much come from the working class. I was surprised at how working class the delegates were at the Republican convention, and how not working class the Democrats were. There were an awful lot of like lawyers and vendors for, you know, people that are on the Democratic committees around the country. But aside from that, the thing that was most interesting to me was contrasting what I just described about the sentiment of the people in the Republican National Convention arena towards these statements, those particular statements that Trump made, and the response of the people on the floor of the Democratic convention when General Allen spoke, when Madeleine Albright spoke. You know, Madeleine, it was worth it to kill 500 Iraqi yeah. children and starve them to death for weapons that didn't exist. Yeah, it was worth it. Albright. The whole legion of those, Michael Bloomberg, you know, Mr. Wall Street. I mean, he is Mr. Wall Street, the ultimate insult to these Sanders people. So you've got these three movements, and you've got, like, the necessity from the point of view of the working class, for them to find some common program and to find each other with all the contradictions that exist. And active attempts, successful in putting down the Sanders people, at least at the convention, and the confrontation that was intended to set off a fight between them and Black Lives Matter in Philadelphia.
Yep. Look, I just want to say one thing here. Nothing about what I'm saying should be taken to be anything close to an endorsement of Trump. I'm as far away from making an endorsement of Trump as I could be, because
okay, everybody has to declare this. It's interesting because a
but
lot
it's
of
important. Yeah, it's, yeah. I think it's important because I don't want anybody to think that by pointing out some of these very interesting developments that somehow means that Trump should be supported, because the negative side of Trump is really, really, really dangerous,
yeah.
in my opinion. And I think that needs to be taken very seriously. And quite frankly, I think that the left has a habit historically of underestimating the danger of things like this and really falling short of its responsibility to confront movements such as what we're seeing now. Because while Trump made that speech, and I nodded my head to a number of things that he said, including his attack on free trade, including his attack on regime change and nation building, including his point about defense of LGBT communities, including his point about
redeveloping the inner cities,
social welfare programs, right. and things like that,
and rebuilding inner cities, things like that.
Exactly. And again, all of that is great. Now it's all just words, right. And so that's really not that significant in and of itself.
Right.
But it is significant when looking at the policy, the platform of what the Republican Party normally is. So it is significant, but none of this should be taken to mean that we're glossing over what he said about being the law and order president and what that really means.
Right.
Law and order in terms of U.S. politics doesn't mean, you know, just keeping the peace in the streets.
Right.
It means bringing force to bear against minority communities. It means really direct violence against blacks and Hispanics and COINTELPRO, Muslims now,
all kinds of things. Before you go there, I just want to note on that particular point. He also made a point a week before the convention of essentially saying, he laid it out. He didn't make the statement, but he laid it out that police officers killing innocent civilians is also a law and order matter.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and again, I mean, we know what base he's speaking to when he's saying that. So I say all of this because I think it is really important that people on the left don't make the mistake that of thinking that Trump, you know, that well, how do I put it? Basically, that anything that's anti-establishment is good.
Right.
I think that that's a mistake. I don't think that that's the way that we should look at our politics, and I certainly don't think that's the way we should be thinking about this election, because we're faced with, two options that are both incredibly dangerous, in my opinion. But the reason I had to preface all of that, because I'm about to say something that could be interpreted as positive about Trump, and I'm not positive about Trump.
So we get 3 minutes of setup. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, look.
Hey, go ahead.
The attacks are there, believe me.
Go ahead.
So anyway, the reason I say all of that is because when you look at what Trump is doing, Trump has now taken away the left from Hillary Clinton, and she's ceded it to him. Mm-hmm. That's the interesting part about this politically.
Yeah, she's going after the right and the Republican base.
Exactly. Just as we said she would. I think you and I were talking about this like 6 months ago, saying that that's what she was going to do. Yep. But the point is here that if Trump actually is able to pull off an electoral victory, I mean, I don't think that's likely at all. But if that were to happen, it would be a monumental shift in U.S. politics, probably the biggest shift since the party switched platforms in Roosevelt's time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that would be really earth-shattering. Now, that being said, though, I want people who are, you know, getting even a twinge of excitement about Trump, specifically with regard to free trade, to answer this question. Do you really believe that Trump can roll back neoliberalism? Do you really believe that Trump as president, with all of the opposition he would face, both in the streets and in the halls of Congress, do you think Trump could actually achieve anything, and especially rolling back free trade? Because remember, free trade is not just about U.S. trade agreements. Free trade is also about a global trade architecture. So whether or not Trump is elected, the U.S. is in the WTO.
Right.
And that's not going anywhere. And Trump ain't taking the U.S. out of the WTO. The Trump is not going to change the consensus around free trade. His whole point is that he wants to renegotiate deals. He wants to make what he claims to be better trade deals,
right.
Not trade deals that, you know, that aren't free trade. And by the way, when Trump gave a speech in front of the Ford factory in Detroit or wherever that was, threatening to close down and move to China, Trump said that he would slap a 35% tariff on any goods coming back into the U.S. that could have been made here. Okay, Mr. Trump, how are you going to do that?
Right.
Because by law, you can't.
Right. Well, I mean,
so look, this is the, yeah.
First of all, the enforcement mechanisms that are written into those treaties certainly would have jurisdiction over the question, and we know how they would find.
Yeah.
The larger court system, however, those established, excuse me, under the Rome Treaty, the United States doesn't submit to its jurisdiction, so... it'll be an interesting legal battle from that point of view. Mechanically speaking, of course, yeah, you're right. Unless some other things develop, you know, if you look at a bipartisan consensus at dismantling the Constitution, for example, and assume that whichever one of them is elected is going to follow that track, it's possible there could be a state of emergency or some other thing declared with respect to the economy, and special powers claimed by the president to impose duties and things that deal directly with the national emergency of job creation or whatever. So who the hell knows where that'll go?
Well, but again, I mean, that's also a very slippery slope too.
I'm not advocating it. I'm saying it's consistent with legal developments in law enforcement and in foreign policy and doctrine of intervention and all of that nonsense. So that's a possibility on all of that. When you're assembling a united front against Trump the fascist, as you move to the hard right, I mean, we're talking hard right now. We had some Black Lives Matter mothers up on the stage, but we also had the families of police officers that were killed featured prominently. And in terms of policy recommendations coming out of the mouths of the speakers, the party speakers, the featured speakers, addressing the problem of police officers being killed and protecting police officers and all of that, had expression in those stated policies, and there was nothing stated in terms of protecting people from being murdered by police.
Yeah,
by the way,
nor does anybody believe that you know, Donald Trump was responsible for developing the mass incarceration state. No,
right.
That was Hillary.
That's right.
That was Hillary and Bill Clinton.
Right. That's right.
You know, the gutting of welfare. Well, no, that was Hillary and Bill Clinton again. Well, the for-profit prison industry. No, right. Again, Bill Clinton. Right. So you know, you see that when you get to the level of policy, in fact, Hillary is just as racist and just as fascistic as Trump when it comes to the macro outcomes. The problem is that Trump emboldens certain elements in this country that we really haven't had to deal with in at least 50, 60 years, you know, that have been kind of latent beneath the surface but haven't really had full political expression. I don't know. When was the last time they had political expression? The Wallace campaign, I guess, yeah. The
Reagan,
campaign for segregation.
Reagan,
you know?
Reagan Democrats, too. You know,
well, but
that was the phenomenon.
But even there, you at least had the sort of patina of political correctness or something like that.
Yeah, you had going on at that time, just prior to the 1980 election, and then through it, like the Boston busing thing, the Bach case with the affirmative action, you know, all of that, and Reagan's campaign taking what then was a hard line, which is what rallied white working class voters to Reagan's campaign.
True. Yeah, that's true. So I suppose in that regard, you're correct. I suppose in that regard, they are similar. But
and then Clinton did it. Then Clinton did it. Sister Soldier, you know, all the way through Hillary's thing, you know, well into the second term about the super predators.
Super predators. Yeah, exactly.
They were
so,
playing that game, too.
Anyway, you know, the point here is that I think, you know, as I was discussing with you, as I've discussed with Tony and with a number of others, I think that we have to really see this election as a moment where we really take stock of just how far back we are here, because how close are we to really developing a united front against both of these people?
Yep.
I think that right now, personally, I think that we're far better organized and far better prepared to confront and to block and to create gridlock with a Trump presidency than we are with Clinton.
Yeah.
With a Trump presidency, you're going to have powers of the establishment arrayed against him, including on the streets.
Yep.
You're going to see, once again, just as we did during the Bush administration, you're going to see all the foundation-funded anti-war hacks, all the NGOs and all the rest of them are all going to turn out every day for anti-Trump protests. Right. And it's going to become very difficult for Trump to really govern with any kind of coalition in mind because, quite frankly, he doesn't even really have a lot of friends in Washington.
You know,
forget, you know, the people who won't vote for him, people who won't support him in Washington.
What we may see happening if Clinton wins is a change from the condition that we have with Obama, because you now have both, if Clinton wins by a slight number, those Trump supporters are going to feel exactly like you described in the setup, you know, that it appears they're trying to make with the Russians intervening in the election. That means they're not going to accept the legitimacy of that election. Neither will the Sanders people, a good part of them. And so you may see a coalescing against Clinton almost as powerful. You won't have the NGOs there and all of that. But in terms of the actual masses of people, and this is Tony's belief, that Clinton may find herself in a situation where the country is ungovernable, as well as Trump.
I it's funny that this keeps coming up, but it has, both in my conversations with him on my own show, in conversations with him on a different show, and in chatting with you and him. I think that, you know, it's funny that I'm going to say this, but Tony is much more optimistic than I am about people's ability to see through those things. I don't personally think that that's very likely. I don't think a major anti-Hillary united front or even a movement of any kind is likely if she wins. I remember and the reason I say that is because I know what liberals are, and liberals are the in my opinion the number one enemy of real change where the system is under threat. I remember back, Don, you might have actually been there now that I think about it. In 2009, it was about, I think it was early March of 2009. So this would have been about 6-8 weeks after Obama was inaugurated into office. I went to the first anti-war protest in Washington since the inauguration. Chris Hedges was a speaker there. Cynthia McKinney was a speaker there. I think Ralph Nader was there. A few other people were there. And it was on the same spot in Lafayette Park where 3 years earlier I had been there with like 40,000 other people.
I was there too. Yeah.
In an anti-war protest. And it was actually an anti-war, anti-Gitmo protest.
That's right.
Then in 2009, I return for an anti-war protest. And from 40,000 people, we were down to literally less than 100.
Right.
Less than 100 people showed up to that anti-war protest to protest against Obama.
Right.
Now, the reason I bring that up is because that to me demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt the power of organized let's call it the foundation funded left. Okay, and the foundation funded left is what makes a protest into a large event. Okay, that is ultimately what has to happen. You got to have that sponsorship. The Soros groups like Move On or whoever, you know, the Code Pinks and the Acorns and whoever else that was people were talking about back at that time, you know, all of that had to be there in order to have a major event, and it wasn't. And so the event was nothing. It was a complete, you know, it was a blip on the radar screen. I think that that is what we'll see with Hillary. I don't think we'll have a major organized movement against Hillary. And even if we do, so what?
Yeah, they won't listen.
That's the problem. Let's say we turn 250,000 people onto the National Mall for to protest against Hillary. Will that change any of the policies? No. It cannot, because that is not how America's political system works. That's I remember 2003 when we had hundreds of thousands of people on the streets to stop the war in Iraq in every city in the country, cities around the world. What did it achieve?
Nothing. Nothing.
Exactly.
On that point, we got to stop here. Eric, we're going to continue to discuss this, among other things, as we go along. And it's a pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks, Don.
You've been listening to CPR Sunday. I'm Don DeBar, your host, and look forward to seeing you again next week.